Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the case of the drug farm labyrinth. We're pleased to be joined by Chris Earhart, who has a PhD in geological and earth sciences from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and is currently an associate professor of forensic science, microbiology and chemistry at Virginia Commonwealth University. Chris, we'd like to start the podcast with a bit of background on yourself, your academic journey, what you're doing and how you do it. So yeah, tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I started off when I was in undergraduate, I was studying molecular biology. I was really fascinated by DNA, you know, sequencing and DNA comparisons and looking at evolutionary history, like molecular ecology and those types of studies. And kind of from there, I switched gears completely for my PhD. And I actually went into geological sciences and earth sciences. And there I was trying to combine molecular biology with sort of geological processes, looking at kind of tracing different geological processes through microbiology. So basically doing geomicrobiology. So we were actually in, for my PhD, we were studying hydrothermal vent microbiology. And so we were trying to find these subsea floor reservoirs of hydrothermal fluid. And we were doing that by basically looking at microbes that were expelled into the water column and using the genetic properties of those microbes to try and figure out where they were expelled from and then where the subsea floor reservoirs were based on where the remnant microbiology was in the water column.
So was that a fairly easy transition or did you find that challenging?
No, it was challenging. I had to kind of go back and, you know, the first couple years of my PhD, I was taking undergrad courses, you know, just to kind of get up to speed on the geology aspect. The microbiology I was all set in. And so it was challenging the first couple years, but the research was really interesting and I really enjoyed the interdisciplinary aspect to it. And kind of oddly enough, sort of as I was nearing the end of my PhD, I was kind of looking to do more applied research. And also, like practically speaking, I got seasick really, really easily. And so I realized that like a career doing ocean microbiology probably wasn't the best because I couldn't take the research cruises for more than a couple days. So I was kind of looking out and when I was looking at different postdoc opportunities, they had an opportunity with the there's a civilian contracting sort of organization here in the United States that actually places postdocs at different federal laboratories, and they had an opening at the counterterrorism research unit at the FBI laboratory in Quantico. And they were actually looking for someone who had geology and microbiology experience. So it was kind of a perfect fit with my background. And when I was a postdoc there at the FBI laboratory, it kind of opened me up to forensics. Like I had never really looked at forensics. I'd never studied it. I had never seen any crime scene show in my life. And so it was a completely new world to me. And it was just so interesting. And it was interesting because, you know, a lot of the techniques in forensic science are being developed now, you know, and so a lot of the things that, you know, we're studying and a lot of the things that are being investigated and developed are relatively new and exciting. And so kind of from that point on, I was just really interested in applying my natural science background, but to forensic science and forensic analyses. And from there, I kind of did a second postdoc at Pacific Northwest National Lab, where I was looking at other types of forensic signatures, more like forensic microbiology. And then from there, I kind of transitioned here to Virginia Commonwealth University, where I teach, and I also do forensic research of different types of evidence samples, but a lot of it focuses on human biological evidence.
So give us a broad definition of what forensics means.
Yeah, so forensics in the realm of my research is Determining the source of evidentiary material. So what we call like the attribution of evidence. So if you have a piece of biological evidence, how do you figure out where it came from? And also sort of the circumstances around how it got there. Basically, it's deposition, who deposited it, what are the other things that you can reconstruct around that piece of evidence that can help with a investigation, a forensic investigation.
You say a lot of the techniques are very new and were being developed as you were working in the area. And is that because the field is new, or is that an evolution of forensics over time?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both. So some of it's just the technology sort of rapidly exploding, just for all areas of science, but then it's sort of being applied to forensics. And the other aspect to it is, you know, within the last 20 years, there's been a big push within the forensic science community to really sort of establish the scientific underpinnings of a lot of the analyses that people have been doing for years and years. And so with that push, some of it is sort of the application of things like, you know, DNA analysis and DNA profiling techniques, but then also kind of understanding the underlying science behind a lot of the other non-DNA based techniques that people have been applying for forensic applications.
Can you give us an example of one of those non-DNA based techniques?
One of the examples, you know, that kind of hits the news a lot is the microscopic, you know, comparisons of like hairs and fibers, of kind of understanding or a lot of different types of trace evidence. So understanding, you know, for years and years, people would sort of make an association and say these two fibers or these two hairs were a match, but they didn't really understand what made it a match, or also when it wasn't a match, or the actual like physical and chemical properties that defined, that made two things similar, as opposed to just sort of looking at the morphology or looking at different physical properties under a microscope.
Wonderful, wonderful. So now in your current teaching position, have you found that a lot of people who are coming through and wanting to learn about this have been very interested in forensics through media? Like you say, this wasn't your experience, but is that something that has come through now?
Yes, overwhelming. I would say the vast, vast, vast majority of students that are in forensic science programs are doing so because they grew up with, you know, CSI TV shows and growing up with those.
And what's their experience like once they actually get into the realness of the subject and what it actually means? Do you find it kind of meshes, or do you find that there's almost a rude awakening as to what actually goes on?
Yeah, no, definitely the latter. It's definitely sort of a rude awakening. I would say sort of anecdotally, what we hear a lot with undergrads and grads when they actually get a job as a forensic examiner, you know, so they're working in a forensic biology laboratory and they're processing samples, and the big misconception is that they're sort of working a case from beginning to end. Or, you know, what we see a lot is students sort of come into forensic science expecting themselves to go to a crime scene, collect the evidence, and then bring it back to the lab and personally analyze it, and then they testify in court. And, you know, that, you know, simply doesn't happen, you know, and so they're sort of disappointed when they get a forensic biology degree. I shouldn't say all of them. Some of them are disappointed when they go in and they're sort of struck by how mundane a lot of the lab analyses are, and how a lot of times they're just sort of part, you know, if they're working up a biology sample, or they're part of the pipeline that develops like a DNA profile. A lot of times what they're doing is they're following a protocol, they're following a lab technique that's been validated, and they're doing that 8 hours a day. And so they get like really disappointed, some of them. They kind of don't realize that.
Great. So I think it's probably time we dive into your story and discuss how you can help the man himself. So before we start our stories, we like to ask our guests which Batman actor they would like to represent their Batman in their story.
Yeah, I kind of grew up watching a lot of Steve McQueen movies, you know, like Towering Inferno and That Great Escape, and I always liked that he was just really calculating, intelligent, and, you know, also sort of athletic, and he just could always kind of solve a problem, fix a problem. So I think Steve McQueen.
We normally actually ask people to choose an actor who has portrayed Batman, but thinking back now, Steve McQueen would have made an incredible Batman. And I very, very much agree with you, and I think that's a great choice. So, thanks for your choice. Mm. News of a new drugs kingpin making a dangerously addictive new substance seeps through Gotham's underworld. Batman believes he's pinpointed the location of the skeleton-staffed R&D lab, thinking that if he cuts off the head of the snake, the rest will fall. In his characteristically subtle way, he crashes through the skylight of the building, sending the lone chemist fleeing. One major problem: the building is a warren with so many doors and exits. How can our hero track him? So Batman is in a situation now where he's in a real maze of a building, and he's got to track this chemist. So how could your research start to even help him be able to track this chemist through this building? How can he find traces? How can he find evidence of where he might be? What can we do here?
Yeah, so I think one of the first things that might help is looking for cells that the villain has left by touching different surfaces. So if he touched like a doorknob, or if he touched any kind of object, every single person, when they touch some sort of object with their hand, deposits sometimes as many as tens of thousands of cells. These cells are basically just sort of shed from all over your body, but specifically from your hands, all the time. And you're transferring those to surfaces. And one of the things that we're looking into now in my lab is how the chemical and also sort of physical properties of those cells can vary between individuals, and also can vary across different traits of the person who deposited them, and how that can be used in a forensic investigation.
Right, so a couple of really basic questions here, actually. So these cells that are coming off, is there a reason they come off? Are they effectively like dead cells? I know it's difficult to define whether a cell is alive or dead, but are they dead cells? Why are they coming off when we touch a doorknob or when we touch a wall? What's happening there?
Yeah, they're definitely dead. So basically your skin is constantly shedding and regenerating cells all the time. And so, at the base of your skin, if you take a thin section through your skin, the base of your skin has sort of cells that we normally think of, cells that are alive, cells that are metabolizing, cells that have nuclei. But over time, those cells basically migrate to the outer surface of your skin. And as they do, it's almost like a really long process of cell death. So they're no longer metabolizing. They degrade all of their cellular compartments. Their nucleus breaks down. The DNA breaks down. So that by the time that the cells make it to the surface, and that's what is exposed to the environment, those cells are basically, I kind of like to call them like their ghost cells. They have almost nothing in them that they did when they were alive. The only thing is they still have a membrane, they have some DNA in them, and they have some chemical characteristics. But for the most part, they're wrapped up in hydrophobic proteins and lipids. And these dead cells that are wrapped up in hydrophobic lipids, they're what the primary barrier that protects your skin or, you know, from your body, from the external environment. And so it's the skin, the outer layer of the skin is mostly a protective function. But as you shed cells, basically those cells get regenerated, or they get replaced by cells sort of migrating from deeper layers of your skin. And so as you touch things, you're just constantly shedding that outer layer of sort of dead cells onto whatever surface you're touching.
Oh, so we're all effectively covered in a layer of death in that sense. Very comic booky. These ideas of these ghost cells, you say that they're not as traditionally what we think of as cells. There's some DNA left in them and some other information. Is that always the case? I mean, do you ever get a situation where, I don't know, if maybe if something is particularly old or not all aspects of the cell have been transferred? What is left? What's the kind of bare minimum, and can you still do anything with that cell?
Yeah, so a lot of times with these forensic samples that are made up of these shed, you know, skin cells, or a lot of times there's very little DNA actually left in these types of forensic samples. But what's interesting is that one of the things we're seeing is that even in any kind of sample that's created from a person touching an object, even if there's no DNA there, we always see cells. And sometimes it's as many as tens to thousands of cells that are these ghost cells that are deposited onto the surface, even when there's very little or no detectable DNA. So one of the things, you know, one of the implications is that, of this is that even when a sample doesn't have genetic information or it does, you can't get a DNA profile of it, there's potentially a lot of forensic information that you can still extract from the sample, looking at just the size and shape and fluorescent properties of the cells that are there, even in the absence of DNA.
This chemist who's been running through, he is touching walls, he's touching doorknobs, he's leaving these cells behind. What can Batman do? How can you help him actually track these cells? Like, what information is being left? How can you differentiate between someone else maybe who touched it the day before? Do they have like a shelf life in that sense, these cells?
That's a good question. You know, the cells are remarkably persistent. They're remarkably stable in terms of where you can find them and how long they last on the surface. And I think what's interesting in terms of what you could analyze them, one of the interesting things that we found in the last couple of years is that people's individual cells actually can fluoresce at different wavelengths. So they can actually sort of, they can fluoresce at different wavelengths and at different colors, essentially, at different intensities too. And this fluorescence can be determined or dictated by a lot of things, or it can be influenced by a lot of things. One of them that we found is that what you touch before you touch the surface, so if you're handling specific objects, a lot of times you can pick up fluorescent chemicals and compounds from the environment, and those compounds get transferred to individual cells. And then when you deposit them by then touching a second substance, your cells are then fluorescent. And it was sort of a really interesting sort of find for us, because it allowed us to potentially identify individuals or differentiate individuals in a forensic sample based on their fluorescent properties.
Right. So fortunately, in this situation, the drug kingpin Batman is chasing has been touching a very particular chemical property, this drug that he's been making. So it would be a reasonable assumption to say that this may make his skin cells fluoresce at a different, what did you say? Was it a different wavelength, a different color? How would they be differentiated?
So it depends on the compound. So I agree, depending on the, you know, if you have a really unusual sort of drug with that has distinctive optical properties, so if it fluoresces at a very specific wavelength, there's a good chance, or there's the possibility that that chemical would get transferred to individual cells. And then if you looked at those cells, like under a microscope or different types of fluorescence instrumentation, the cells would have that entire fluorescent property of the particular chemical. So if you were sort of handling a specific substance a lot, that substance would be covering your epidermal cells, and then you would be depositing those fluorescent skin cells on anything else you touched throughout the day.
And what does that process of transfer all look like? Because you don't often see this just obviously with the naked eye. If you're looking at your skin, maybe you'll see occasional staining or something, but you would wash that off and it would go away. Or when you say transfer, what does that actually mean?
You mean how do you visualize
it? So is it actually changing the properties of the cell? You say it's coating it?
We think it's coating it. It's sticking to the outside. We haven't confirmed that yet, but it's sort of the compounds that we see that actually seem to transfer or change the fluorescence of cells. I always think of it, it's similar to like if you're at a gas station, you accidentally get a little bit of gas on your hands. It's really hard to wash that gasoline off. Like, you still smell the gasoline like throughout the day. And so we think that depending on the compound, that compound basically sticks to the outside of the cell. And then, you know, if you're looking at it in a microscope, or if you're doing any kind of fluorescence instrument, if it's coating the outside of the cell, it looks like the entire cell is fluorescent.
And how did you discover this? Did you have any examples or experiences in your lab that brought this up?
Yes, we did. We actually kind of stumbled upon it in the early stages of this project a few years ago. We were just looking at just fluorescence variation across individuals. So we were sampling people in my lab and people in the school and just sort of looking at fluorescent profiles. And, you know, in the first 20 people we analyzed, there was 19 of them just showed no difference. Like there were very few differences in the fluorescence profile. So everyone had the same, you know, wavelength, the same intensity, except for one person. There was one person in my lab that continually deposited like really, really fluorescent cells. And it was at a really weird wavelength. I say weird in the sense that it was kind of shifted a bit from wavelengths that people normally investigate for fluorescence. So it was shifted. It had a higher wavelength, so it was around 670 nanometers, which is unusual. And so, you know, I kind of took a couple months and I said, you know, I was kind of doing, you know, deep dives on the internet. And I was trying to figure out what would cause fluorescence in this really odd area of the spectrum. And I was looking, and I sort of discovered that that area of the spectrum is consistent with particular fluorescent or chlorophyll-containing compounds in plants. And so I talked to the student, you know, kind of over the week, and I said, you know, it's really interesting. Your cells are fluorescing at this wavelength that's kind of consistent with plant pigments and plant molecules. And the student said to me, he goes, oh, I got it. And I said, what? And he goes, I drink kale milkshakes every single morning. And I said, okay. And I said, but, you know, you're washing your hands, right? He goes, yeah. And I said, I don't think that's it. He goes, no, I farm my own kale and I really work it. I take a bunch in the morning and I just, you know, wash it for like 10 minutes and I'm just working it with my hands. I'm like, well, okay, maybe. And I said, and I, you know, for the lack of anything else that, you know, we had to test, we tested it. So I went to the grocery store, I bought some kale and I bought organic kale and I bought collard greens and we had different members of the lab just lightly touch. So, you know, pick up the bunch of kale, pick up the collard green bunch, deposit it and then, you know, touch a knife or deposit, you know, your cells on some sort of surface. And sure enough, you know, like everyone that just even lightly touched the kale, their cells were blazingly red in terms of the fluorescence, which is the same wavelength. And, you know, still it didn't kind of make we were just really surprised by that. And then we started thinking, well, what else causes it? Like it can't just be kale. That would be sort of that's interesting, but not too useful for forensic science. And so we started looking at other things and, you know, sort of we started noticing other fluorescent variation between members of the lab, but it was really variable across days. So one day someone would be really fluorescent and then another day they wouldn't be. So it it really kind of hit home that this is something that regards to what they're touching. And so we found other molecules too, or other compounds. So we found that if someone wears laboratory gloves, like the nitrile gloves that you would wear to protect your hands during laboratory work, a lot of times that actually caused their cells to be fluorescent after they took the gloves off. You know, marker ink does it. Certain types of spray or gel that you actually come into contact with changes the fluorescent properties of your cells.
Wow, what a great story. Thanks for sharing. Going back to this tracking, is there any other information that gets left behind when we are touching things? So you said we have this fluorescence, which is one way of being able to possibly track this guy through the building. But do we leave any other information about if it's a man, anything around age, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. We are starting to see evidence that that the size, you know, so basically how big the cell is and also aspects of its morphology can vary between sexes, between males and females. And what's kind of interesting is, you know, when we start to see really statistically significant and consistent differences between the size and shape of skin cells between men and women. And what's interesting is that people have hypothesized this for, you know, 30 or 40 years. You can go back into the, you know, dermatology literature from the 70s and 80s, and people sort of made individual microscopic measurements of different cells, and they found, you know, some differences between men and women, and they also found differences between ages. So depending on, you know, like if you're an infant versus middle-aged versus you know, older, senior, that can have an impact on size, shape, and different types of optical properties of your cells. And so what's really exciting about what we're doing is we're starting to test all of those anecdotal observations over the last, 30 years and try to see if it's something that we can exploit for forensics. If we sort of increase survey, dozens to hundreds of individuals, is this signature robust enough to extract things like age, sex, and other types of information about the individuals who deposited the cells.
Could you just define morphology for us as well before we move along?
Yeah, so morphology meaning the shape. So depending on, some cells will have more irregular sort of shape and outline, or some will be more perfectly circular, and there will be more subtle variations. So like the ratio of the length versus the width or the diameter of cells combine to define its size, its area, and then also, its rough general sort of shape of the cell.
Right, thank you. So you said they're remarkably resilient once they've kind of left the body and been left on the surface. Is there any evidence of like degradation over time of like the intensity of the fluorescence, or do these things kind of fall away? Do they break down?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in terms of when the fluorescence is derived from, or when it comes from a compound that's associated, we haven't seen any degradation over the course of, we've tested up to maybe 2 weeks old, roughly, so after deposited and it's sort of sitting out. We're in the process of testing longer time frames, but that would be, that's a really good question of understanding the limit. One thing we do see is with other types, other signatures of fluorescence or other optical properties, we do see that it decays with time, like it sort of degrades over time. But what's really interesting is that that degradation happens at a very specific rate, such that we might be able to use it as a clock for how long the cell has been there. So we can actually look at sort of how much the fluorescence has degraded in the cell and be able to say, this was deposited 24 hours ago, or this was deposited 72 hours ago, or more than a month ago, and this is something that we're looking into right now. We're starting to see evidence of this.
Right. So assuming Batman has the most advanced tech in the world, which being the world's greatest detective, he clearly has, what kind of thing would he need, maybe some kind of visual representation, to be able to track this? How would he transfer what you do in the lab into something he could use in his bat suit, or with a scanner or some kind of sensor? How might this work?
So it's true. So the kind of things that we use in the lab are usually sort of they're high throughput fluorescence measurement instruments, but they're large and they're expensive. But one of the things we're looking into now is there's been a lot of work as to how do you see cells and actually detect their presence with things like a cell phone or an attachment onto your cell phone microscope, or creating a cell phone microscope. And so that's actually something that we're looking into now, is to how do you actually visualize cells really rapidly, either on the scene, to sort of make some of these assessments about where the cells are and where someone is. And so the kind of the portable technology is definitely there, and this is something that we're looking into, sort of adapting these signatures so that you could see it with a device, that's attached to a bat suit.
Would you also need something like a suitable AI maybe to very quickly give you a person, an age, a particular chemical property that you're looking for, and be able to translate and identify that on the fly? Is that within the realms of possibilities?
Yes, definitely. So a lot of the signatures we're seeing are, it's sort of based on a database of cells and signatures. And so for kind of on-the-spot detection and analysis, yeah, it would have to sort of either be connected to a machine learning network, which is something that we've been using, or some sort of identification framework, something to interpret the fluorescence or kind of size, properties of these cells into what those signatures translate into. So like sex or age or chemical compounds.
So that's all for now. Batman catches the criminal again, thanks to Chris's and team's amazing work. And thanks to Chris for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Chris's research at cellforensics.lab.vcu.edu. you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info@figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.